these frightening effects to rattle around the courtroom. Then he stepped to the defense table and picked up some papers. Slowly he returned to the podium and said, "Now, Dr. Majeski, you said you've performed over 2,000 autopsies in your distinguished career."
"That's correct."
"How many of those deaths were caused by alcohol poisoning?"
Dyer stood again and said, "Objection, Your Honor, on the grounds of relevance. We're not concerned here with the death of anyone else."
"Mr. Brigantz, Your Honor, this is a cross-examination, and I'm given wide latitude. The drunkenness of the deceased is certainly relevant.
I'll allow for now, but let's see where it's going. You may answer the question, Dr. Majeski."
The witness shifted his weight, but was obviously enjoying the chance to discuss his experience and knowledge.
"I'm not sure exactly, but there have been several.
Last year, you did the autopsy for a fraternity boy down in Gulfport. Last name of Cooney. Do you remember that one?"
"I do, yes. Very sad."
Jake glanced at his paperwork. "You concluded that the cause of death was AAP, acute alcohol poisoning, correct?"
"Correct."
"Do you remember the kid's BAC?"
"No, I'm sorry."
"I have your report right here. Would you like to see it?"
"No, just refresh my memory, Mr. Brigantz."
Jake lowered the papers, looked at the jury, and said, "0.33.
"That sounds accurate," Dr. Majeski said.
Jake returned to his table, shuffled some papers, withdrew a few, and returned to the podium. "Do you recall an autopsy you performed in August of 1987 on a Meridian fireman named Pellegrini?" Dyer stood with stretched arms and said,
"Your Honor, please, I object to this line of questioning on the grounds of relevance." "Overruled. You may answer the question."
Dyer fell hard into his chair, and his theatrics drew a harsh look from the bench. Dr. Majeski said,
"Yes, I remember that one."
Jake scanned the top sheet, though all the details were memorized. "Says here he was 44 years old and weighed 192 pounds. His body was found in the basement of his home. You concluded that the cause of death was AAP. Does this sound right, Doctor?"
"Yes, it does."
"Do you happen to recall his BAC?"
"Not exactly, no."
Again, Jake lowered the papers, looked at the jury, and announced, "0.32. He glanced at Joey Kepner and saw the faint beginnings of a smile. "Dr. Majeski, is it safe to say that Stuart Kofor was near death from his alcohol consumption?" Dyer bounced up again and angrily said,
"Objection, Your Honor! This calls for an opinion that is far too speculative." "It does indeed."
"Objection sustained." After a perfect buildup, Jake was ready for the punchline. He stepped toward his table, stopped, looked at the witness, and asked, "Isn't it possible, Dr. Majeski, that Stuart Kofor was already dead when he got shot?" Dyer yelled,
"Objection, Your Honor!"
"Sustained. Don't answer that." "Nothing further," Jake said as he glanced at the spectators. Harry Rex was grinning. On the back row, Lucian beamed at his protege and could not have been prouder. Most of the jurors appeared to be stunned. It was almost 3, and His Honor needed another round of meds. He said,
"Let's take the afternoon recess and get some coffee. I'd like to see the lawyers in chambers."
Lowell Dyer was still fuming when they gathered around the table. Noose had disrobed and was lining up little bottles of pills as he stretched at his desk. He gulped them down with a cup of water and took a seat at the table. He smiled and said,
"Well, gentlemen, with no insanity to fight over, this trial is moving right along. My compliments to both of you."
He looked at the prosecutor and asked,
Who's your next witness?
Dyer tried to shrug it off and appear as cool as his opponent. He took a deep breath and said,
I don't know, Judge. I plan to call Kira Gamble to the stand, but right now, I'm somewhat reluctant.
Why?
Because we'll get into the abuse. As I've said before, it's simply not fair to allow these people to testify to matters that I cannot effectively rebut on cross-examination. It's not fair to allow them to slander Stuart Kofa.
Slander? Jake asked.
Slander implies false testimony, Lowell. But we don't know what's false and what's true.
They'll be under oath, Noose said.
True. But they'll also have every reason to exaggerate the abuse. There is no one to rebut it.
Jake said, The facts are the facts, Lowell. We can't change them. The truth is that these three were living in a nightmare because they were abused and threatened, and the abuse was a major factor in the killing.
So it was for retribution.
I didn't say that.
Gentlemen, we've been discussing this for some time, and I have been briefed by both sides. I am persuaded that the case law in this state leans toward the exploration of the reputation of the deceased, especially in a factual setting like this. Therefore, I will allow it to a point. If I believe that the witnesses are exaggerating, as you say, Mr. Dyer, then you can always object and we'll revisit the issue. We'll take it slow. We have plenty of time and there is no hurry.
Then the state rests, John. We've proven our case beyond a reasonable doubt. The intoxication of the deceased does not alter the fact that he was murdered by Drew Gamble, whether on duty or not.
Jake mumbled, What a ridiculous law.
It's on the books, Jake. We can't change it.
Gentlemen, Noose grimaced in pain and tried to stretch.
It's going on 4 o'clock. I have an appointment with a physical therapist at 5:30. I'm not whining, but my lower lumbar needs some work. It is difficult to sit for more than 2 or 3 hours at a time. Let's dismiss the jury, take an early recess, and reconvene in the morning at 9 sharp.
Jake was pleased. The jurors would go home with Kofer's blackout drinking fresh on their minds. Chapter 45. Dinner at Jake's office was another round of sandwiches, though far tastier. Carla rushed home from the trial, gathered Hannah, and together they grilled chicken and put together gourmet-style paninis. They delivered them to the office and ate with Libby, Josie, and Kira. Portia was at home checking on her mother and would rejoin the team for another late session. Harry Rex was at his office putting out fires, while Lucian begged off and needed a drink. As they ate, they replayed the day's events, from the prosecutor's opening statement through all the testimony. As upcoming witnesses, Josie and Kira were still banned from the courtroom and were eager to hear what had transpired. Jake assured them that Drew was holding up just fine and being taken care of. They worried about his safety, but Jake said he was well guarded. The courtroom was full of Kofers and their friends, and it was undoubtedly a painful spectacle for them to endure. But so far, no one had misbehaved. They talked about the jurors as if they were old friends. Libby thought number 7, Mrs. Fife, was particularly disgusted by Kofers drinking. Number 2, Mr. Poole, a deacon in the First Baptist Church and strict teetotaler, seemed bothered by it too.
Jake said, Wait till they hear the rest of the story. The drinking will seem like child's play.
They covered all 12. Carla didn't like number 11, Miss Twitchell. age 24, the youngest and the only one not married. She had a sneer that never went away, and she continually glared at Drew. At 8, Hannah was bored with whatever the adults were doing in the big room and wanted to go home. Carla left to put her to bed. Despite the boredom, she was thoroughly enjoying the trial itself because the long days were being spent with Jake's parents. Portia returned and went to the library for some research. Jake said, "Okay, Josie, you're the first one up tomorrow. We're going to talk through your testimony again, word for word. Libby will play the role of the prosecutor and fire away whenever she wants." "Again?" Josie asked, already tired. "Yes, again and again. And Kira, you're next. Keep in mind, Josie, that after you testify, you will be released and you can stay in the courtroom. Kira will be called next. So I want you to listen and observe everything she says and does as we go through it again."
"Got it. Let's have it."
Another storm at daybreak knocked out the electricity. An automatic generator in the courthouse failed to kick on, and by 7:30, the elderly janitorial crew was scrambling to fix the problems. When Judge News arrived at 8:15, the lights were at least flickering, a hopeful sign. He called the power company and raised hell, and half an hour later, the lights came on for good. The window units sputtered to life and began straining to combat the thick humidity in the courtroom. When he assumed the bench at 9 o'clock, his robe was already wet around the collar.
"Good morning," he said loudly into his mic, which was working at full volume. "Seems as though we lost power in the storm a few hours ago. It has been restored, but I'm afraid the heat will be with us for a few hours."
Jake cursed him for selecting that badly designed and dilapidated old building for a trial in August, but only in passing. He had more important matters on his mind.
"Bring in the jury," News said.
They filed in, dressed for the day in short-sleeve shirts and cotton dresses. As they took their seats, a bailiff handed each a funeral fan, a decorative piece of cardboard glued to a stick, as if flapping it back and forth in front of their noses would bring relief from the stifling heat. Many of the spectators were already waving them.
News said, "Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I apologize for the loss of power and the heat, but the show must go on. I will allow the attorneys to remove their jackets, but keep the ties, please. Mr. Brigance."
Jake stood and smiled as he turned the podium to face the jury. With his jacket still on, he began with, "Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm allowed at this time to make a few remarks about what I hope to prove in the defense of Drew Gamble. Now, I am not going to risk losing credibility with you by suggesting that there might be questions about who shot Stuart Kofer. It's pretty clear. Mr. Lowell Dyer, our fine district attorney, did a masterful job yesterday proving the state's case. Now it's up to the defense to tell you the rest of the story. And there is so much more to the story. What we will attempt to do is describe the nightmare that Josie Gamble and her two children were living." With a clenched fist, he tapped the podium in rhythm as he said, "It was a living hell." He paused for a second, then tapped out, "They are lucky to be alive." A little too dramatic, Harry Rex thought. Not nearly loud enough, Lucian said to himself. About a year ago, Josie and Stuart met in a bar, which was fitting for both of them. Josie had spent plenty of time in bars and honky-tonks, as had Stuart, and it should be no surprise that that's where they met. Josie told him she lived in Memphis and was visiting a friend, one who did not happen to be in the bar. She was alone. It was a lie. Josie and her two children were living in a borrowed camper on the property of a distant relative who had told them to leave. They had no place to go. A romance of sorts quickly ensued, with Josie in hot pursuit once she learned that Stuart owned his own home. And he was a deputy in Ford County, a man with a good paycheck. She's a cute girl, likes tight jeans and other clothing that might be considered suggestive. And Stuart was smitten. You'll meet her in a minute. She's our first witness, the mother of the defendant. With Josie pushing hard, Stuart invited her to move in. He didn't want her kids because, by his own admission, he wasn't cut out for fatherhood. But it was a package deal. For the first time in 2 years, the Gambles had a real roof over their heads. For about a month, things were okay. Tense, but survivable. Then Stuart began complaining about how much the arrangement was costing him. The kids ate too much, he said. Josie was working two jobs at minimum wage, that's all she ever earned, and trying her best to support the family. Then the beatings started, and violence became a way of life. Now, you've heard a lot about Stuart and what kind of person he was when sober. Mercifully, that was most of the time. He never missed a day of work, never showed up drunk. Sheriff Wall said he was a good deputy and really enjoyed law enforcement when he wasn't drinking. But once on the bottle, he became a vile, vicious, violent man. He loved the honky-tonks, the nightlife, hard drinking with his buddies, and he was a brawler. Loved a good fistfight, liked to shoot dice. Almost every Friday and Saturday night after work, he hit the bars and would come home drunk. Sometimes he was aggressive and looking for trouble. Other times, he just went to bed and passed out. Josie and her kids learned to leave him alone and hide in their rooms, praying there would be no trouble. But there was trouble, and plenty of it. The kids begged their mother to leave, but there was no place to go, nowhere to run. As the violence grew worse, she begged him to get help, to cut back on the drinking, and to stop hitting them. But Stuart was out of control. She threatened to leave him on several occasions, and this always sent him into a rage. He called her names, cursed her in front of the kids, made fun of her because she had nowhere to go, called her trailer park trash. Dyer stood and said, "Your Honor, I object on the grounds of hearsay." Sustained. Jurors number 3 and 9 lived in trailers. Jake ignored Dyer and Noose and concentrated on the faces of 3 and 9. He continued, "On Saturday night, March 24, Stuart was out. In fact, he'd been gone all afternoon, and Josie was expecting the worst. They waited as the hours passed. Midnight came and went. The kids were upstairs in Kira's room with the lights off, hiding, hoping their mother wouldn't get hurt again. They were in Kira's room because her door was sturdier and the lock worked better. They knew this from experience. The previous door had been kicked in by Stuart during one of his rages. Josie was downstairs, waiting for the headlights to appear in the driveway. He paused for a long time, then said, "You know, I'll let them tell the story." He stepped behind the podium, glanced at his notes, and wiped sweat from his forehead. But for the funeral fans and the constant hum of the window units, the courtroom was silent and still. Ladies and gentlemen, this is not a clear-cut case of premeditated murder. Far from it. We will prove that during that horrifying moment, with his mother unconscious on the kitchen floor, with Stuart blind drunk and stomping through the house, with his sister crying and begging their mother to wake up, with both children alone and vulnerable, with the history of indescribable violence scarred into their frightened souls, with the belief that they were not safe and would never be safe from that man,
What little Drew Gamble did was entirely justified.
Jake nodded at the jurors and turned to face the judge.
Your Honor, we are ready with our first witness, Josie Gamble.
Very well. Please call her to the stand.
No one moved as Josie made her entrance. Jake met her at the railing, opened the low gate of the bar, and pointed to the witness stand. Because she had been superbly coached, she stopped by the court reporter, offered her a smile, and swore to tell the truth. For the occasion, she wore a simple sleeveless white blouse tucked into a pair of black linen slacks and brown flat sandals. Nothing was tight or revealing. Her short blonde hair was pulled back. No lipstick, little makeup. Carla was in charge of her appearance, and after studying the five female jurors, she had loaned her the blouse and sandals and bought the slacks. The goal was to appear attractive enough to please the seven men, but simple enough not to threaten the women. Her 32 years had been hard, and she looked at least 10 years older. Still, she was younger than most of the jurors and in better shape than virtually all of them. Jake began with some basic questions, and in doing so, elicited her current address, which until then was unknown. The bill collectors had not found her in Oxford, and he had debated which address to use. Without too much detail, they went through her past. Two pregnancies before she was 17, no high school diploma, two bad marriages, the first conviction for possessing drugs at the age of 23, a year in the county jail, the second drug conviction in Texas that landed her in prison for 2 years. She owned her past, said she was not proud of it, and would give anything if she could go back and change things. She was at once stoic and vulnerable. She managed to smile at the jurors a time or two without making light of the situation. Her biggest regret was what she had done to her children, the lousy example she had set. Her voice cracked slightly when she talked about them, and she wiped her eyes with a tissue. Though every question and answer was thoroughly scripted, the conversation seemed genuine. Her story unfolded with ease at times, and with pain at other times. Jake held a legal pad as if he needed a prompt, but every word had been committed to memory and rehearsed. Libby and Portia could recite the exchange verbatim. Switching gears, Jake said, "Now, Josie, on December the 3rd of last year, you made a 911 call to the county dispatcher. What happened?" Dyer stood and said, "Objection, Your Honor. Why is this relevant to the murder on March the 25th?
Mr. Brigance?
Your Honor, this 911 call is already before the jury. Sheriff Walls testified about it yesterday. It's relevant because it goes to the abuse, violence, and fear these people were living with leading up to the events of March 25th.
Overruled, Mr. Brigance.
Jake said, "Josie, tell us what happened on December the 3rd. She hesitated and took a deep breath, as if dreading the recall of another bad night.
"It was a Saturday around midnight, and Stuart came home in a foul mood, very drunk as usual. I was wearing jeans and a t-shirt, no bra, and he began accusing me of sleeping around. This happened all the time. He liked to call me a slut and a whore, even in front of my children."
Dyer jumped up again and said, "Objection! This is hearsay, Your Honor."
Judge New said, "Sustained," and looked down at the witness.
"Ms. Gamble, I'll ask you not to repeat specific statements made by the deceased."
"Yes, sir."
It happened just the way Jake said it would, but her words would not be forgotten by the jurors.
"You may continue,"
She said,
"Anyway, he flew into a rage and slapped me across the mouth, busted my lip, and there was blood. He grabbed me, and I tried to fight him, but he was so strong and angry. I told him that if he hit me again, I was leaving, which made matters worse. I managed to get away and ran to the bedroom, locked the door. I thought he was going to kill me. I called 911 and asked for help. I cleaned up my face and sat on the bed for a while. The kids were upstairs hiding in their bedrooms. I listened to see if he was bothering them. After a few minutes, I came out, went to the den. He was in his recliner, a chair we couldn't touch, drinking a beer and watching television. I told him the cops were on the way, and he laughed at me. He knew they wouldn't do anything because he knew them all. They were his buddies. He told me that if I pressed charges, he would kill me and the kids."
"Did the police arrive?"
"Yes. Deputy Swayze came out. By then, Stuart had settled down, and he did a good job of faking it. Said everything was okay, just a little domestic spat. The deputy looked at my face. My cheek and lips were swollen, and he noticed some blood at the corner of my mouth. He knew the truth. He asked me if I wanted to press charges, and I said no. They left the house together, went outside, smoked a cigarette, just a couple of old friends. I went upstairs and spent the night with the kids in Kira's room. He didn't come after us."
She dabbed her eyes with the tissue and looked at Jake, ready to proceed. He said, "On February the 24th of this year, you called 911 again. What happened?" Dyer stood and objected. Noose glared at him and said, "Overruled. Continue."
"It was a Saturday, and that afternoon a preacher, Brother Charles McGarry, had stopped by the house, just paying a call, you know. We had been visiting his church down the road, and Stuart didn't like it. When the preacher knocked on the door, Stuart got a beer and went into the backyard somewhere. He didn't go out that night for some reason, just hung around the house watching basketball games and drinking. I sat with him and tried to have a chat, you know. I asked him if he wanted to go to church with us the next day. He did not. He didn't like church and didn't like preachers and told me that McGarry was not welcome ever again in his house. It was always his house, never our house."
Charles and Meg McGarry sat two rows behind the defense table, waiting for Josie to join them. "Why did you call 911? Jake asked. She patted her forehead with the tissue.
"Well, we started arguing about the church, and he told me I couldn't go back there. I said I'd go any time I wanted. He was yelling, and I wasn't backing down, and suddenly he threw a can of beer at me. It hit me in the eye and cut my eyebrow. I was covered in beer, and I ran to the bathroom and saw the blood. He was banging on the door, cussing like crazy, calling me all the usual names. I was afraid to come out, and I just knew he was about to kick in the door. He finally quit and left, and I heard him in the kitchen. So I ran to the bedroom, locked the door, and called 911. It was a mistake, because I knew the police wouldn't bother him. But I was scared to death and wanted to protect the kids. He heard me on the phone and started banging on the bedroom door. Said he would kill me if the cops showed up. After a few minutes, he settled down and said he wanted to talk. I didn't want to talk, but I knew if he blew up again, he might hurt me or the kids. So I came out, went to the den where he was sitting, and for the first and only time, he said he was sorry. He begged me to forgive him and promised to get some help with his drinking. He seemed sincere, but he was only worried about the 911 call."
"Had you been drinking, Josie?"
"No. I have a beer every now and then, but never in front of my kids. I really can't afford to drink."
"When did the police arrive?"
"Around 10. When I saw the headlights, I went outside to meet them. I said I was okay. Things had settled down. It was just a misunderstanding. I was holding a bloody rag over my eye, and they asked what happened. I said I fell in the kitchen, and they seemed eager to believe this.
Did they talk to Stuart?
Yes. He came outside, and I went in. I could hear them laughing as they smoked a cigarette.
And you didn't press charges?
No.
Jake walked to the defense table and took off his jacket. His armpits were soaked with sweat, and the back of his light blue Oxford cloth was stuck to his skin. He returned to the podium and said, "What efforts did Stuart take to control his drinking?"
"None whatsoever. It just got worse."
On the night of March 25th, were you at home with your children?
Yes.
Where was Stuart?
Out. I don't know where he was. He'd been gone all afternoon.
What time did he come home?
It was after 2 in the morning. I was waiting. The kids were upstairs, supposedly asleep, but I could hear them moving around quietly. I guess all of us were waiting.
What happened when he got home?
Well, I put on a little negligee, one that he liked, thinking, you know, that maybe I could get him in the mood for a little romance, anything to prevent more violence.
How'd that work out?
It didn't. He was blind drunk, had trouble walking and standing up. His eyes were glazed over. His breathing was very heavy. I'd seen him plenty drunk, but nothing like that.
What happened?
He saw what I was wearing and didn't like it. He started his accusations. I didn't want another fight because of the kids. God, they hurt so much.
Her voice cracked, and she broke down. Her sobbing was unscripted, but real and perfectly timed. She closed her eyes and covered her mouth with the tissue as she fought the tears. Libby noticed number 7, Mrs. Fife, drop her head and clench her jaws, seemingly ready to shed a sympathetic tear. After a painful, silent moment, Judge Noose leaned over and said softly, "Would you like to take a break, Miss Gamble?" She shook her head firmly, gritted her teeth, and looked at Jake. He said, "Josie, I know this is not easy, but you have to tell the jury what happened." She nodded rapidly and said,
"He slapped me hard across the face, and I almost fell down. Then he grabbed me from behind, had his thick forearm around my neck, and was choking me. I knew it was the end, and all I could think about was my kids. Who would raise them? Where would they go? Would he hurt them, too? It all happened so fast. He was growling, cussing, and I could smell his awful breath. I managed to elbow him in the ribs and tear myself away. Before I could run, he hit me hard with his fist. That's the last thing I remember. He knocked me unconscious."
"You don't remember anything else?"
"Nothing. When I woke up, I was in the hospital."
Jake stepped to the defense table, where Libby handed him an enlarged color photo. "Your Honor, I'd like to approach the witness." "Proceed." Jake handed the photo to Josie and asked her, "Can you identify this photograph?"
"Yes. It was taken of me the following day in the hospital."
"Your Honor, I'd like to enter into the record this photo as defense exhibit number 1. Lowell Dyer, who had copies of 8 photos taken of Josie, rose and said, "The state objects on the grounds of relevancy. Overruled. It is admitted into evidence." Jake said, "Your Honor, I'd like the jury to see this evidence." "Proceed." Jake took the remote, pressed a button, and the startling image of a battered woman splashed onto the wide screen on the wall opposite the jurors. Everyone in the courtroom could see it. Josie in the hospital bed, the left side of her face swollen grotesquely, her left eye shut, thick gauze covering her chin and wrapped around her head. A tube ran into her mouth. Others hung from above. Her face was unrecognizable. Every juror reacted. Some shifted uncomfortably. Some leaned forward as if a few inches would provide a better look at what was perfectly clear. Number 5, Mr. Carpenter, shook his head. Number 8, Mrs. Satterfield, stared open-mouthed as if in disbelief. Harry Rex would later say that Janet Kofor dropped her head. Jake asked, "Do you know what time you woke up?"
"Around 8 that morning," they said. "I was on painkillers and other stuff and pretty groggy."
"How long were you in the hospital?"
"That was Sunday. On Wednesday, they moved me to the hospital in Tupelo for surgery to reset my jaw. It was shattered. I was released on Friday."
"And did you make a full recovery from your injuries?" She nodded and said,
"I'm fine."
Jake had other photos of Josie in the hospital, but at that moment, they were not needed. He had other questions, but Lucian had taught him years ago to quit when you're ahead. When you've driven home your points, leave something to the imagination of the jurors. He said, "I tender the witness." Noose said, "Let's take a break. 15-minute recess." Lowell Dyer and his assistant Musgrove huddled in a first-floor restroom and tried to decide what to do next. Normally, a convicted felon was easy to cross-examine because his or her credibility was questionable. But Josie had already talked about her convictions and some of her other problems as well. She was forthcoming, credible, sympathetic, and the jury would never forget the image of her in the hospital. They agreed that they had no choice but to attack from some angle. When Josie retook the stand, Dyer began with, "Ms. Gamble, how many times have you lost custody of your children?"
"Twice."
"What was the first time?"
"Approximately 10 years ago. Drew was around 5 or so. Kira was 3.
"And why did you lose custody?"
"They were taken away by the state of Louisiana."
"And why did this happen?"
"Well, Mr. Dyer, I was not a very good mother back then. I was married to a small-time drug dealer who peddled his goods out of our apartment. Someone complained, and social services came in, got him, and took me to court."
"Were you selling drugs, too?"
"Yes, I was. I'm not proud of it. I wish I could do many things over, Mr. Dyer."
"What happened to your kids?"
"They were placed in foster care. In good homes, I got to see them occasionally. I split up with the guy, got a divorce, and managed to get my kids back."
"What happened the second time?"
"I was living with a house painter who also sold drugs. He got caught and plea bargained his way out by telling the authorities that the drugs belonged to me. A bad lawyer convinced me to plead to a lesser sentence, and I got sent away to a women's prison in Texas. Served 2 years. Drew and Kira were placed in a Baptist orphanage in Arkansas and were treated very well."
"Don't volunteer too much," Jake had warned her repeatedly. At the moment, she felt as though she knew every question Dyer might throw at her. "Do you still use drugs?"
"No, sir, I don't. I quit years ago for the sake of my kids."
"Did you ever sell drugs?"
"Yes."
"So you admit that you've used drugs, sold drugs, lived with drug dealers, been arrested? How many times?"
"4.
"Arrested 4 times, convicted 2, and served time in prison."
"I'm not proud of any of that, Mr. Dyer."
"Who would be? And you expect this jury to believe in your credibility as a witness and believe all of your testimony?"
"Are you calling me a liar, Mr. Dyer?"
"I'll ask the questions, Ms. Gamble. Your job is to answer them."
"Yes. I expect the jury to believe every word I've said because it's all true. I may have lied before, but I assure you that lying was the least of my sins."
The smart move would be to stop the bleeding. She was scoring far more points than the prosecutor. Brigance had her prepped to the max, and she was ready for anything. Dyer was a smart man. He fumbled with some papers and finally said, "Nothing further, Your Honor." Chapter 46. Kira entered the courtroom with a bailiff trailing behind. She walked slowly, looking down to avoid the stairs. She wore a simple, drip-dry cotton dress that was tight around the middle. By the time she stopped and faced the court reporter, everyone in the courtroom was staring at her belly. There were whispers in the gallery, and several of the jurors glanced around as if embarrassed for this poor child. She backed into the witness chair and sat gingerly, obviously uncomfortable. She glanced at the jurors as if ashamed, a terrified kid facing an adult's screwed-up world. Jake said, "You are Kira Gamble, sister of the accused, correct?"
"Yes, sir."
"How old are you, Kira?"
14.
"You are obviously pregnant."
"Yes, sir."
Jake had played this scene 1,000 times, had lost hours of sleep over it, and had argued and debated and dissected it with his wife and his team. He couldn't blow it. Calmly, he asked, "When is your baby due, Kira?"
"Late next month."
"And Kira, who is the father of your child?" As coached, she leaned a bit closer to the mic and said,
"Stuart Kofer."
There were gasps and loud reactions, and almost immediately, Earl Kofer yelled, "That's a damn lie!" He stood and pointed at her and said, "That's a damn lie, Judge!" Janet Kofer shrieked and buried her face in her hands. Barry Kofer said loudly, "What a crock of shit!" "Order! Order!" Noose yelled back angrily. He rapped his gavel as Earl yelled again, "How much more of this shit do we have to take, Judge? It's a damn lie! Order in the court! We will maintain decorum!" Two uniformed bailiffs were scurrying to Earl on the third row behind the prosecution. He was waving his finger and yelling, "This is not fair, Judge! My boy is dead, and they lying about him! Lies! Lies! Lies!" "Remove that man from the courtroom," Noose barked into his mic. Cecil Kofer stood next to his father, as if ready for a brawl. The first two bailiffs to reach them were 70 years old and already winded, but the third was a rookie who stood 6'5", was ripped at 240, and held a black belt. He lifted Cecil under a wet armpit while grabbing Earl by the elbow. He dragged them, cussing and twisting, to the aisle, where they were met by other bailiffs and deputies and quickly realized the futility of any further resistance. They were shoved to the door, where Earl stopped and turned around and yelled, "I'll get you for this, Brigance!" Jake, along with everyone else in the courtroom, watched and listened in stunned silence. Other than Janet Kofer's sobbing and the window units, there were no other sounds as the moment passed. Kira sat in the witness chair and wiped her eyes. Lowell Dyer glared at Jake as if he might throw a punch. The jurors appeared to be overwhelmed. His Honor quickly regrouped and barked at a bailiff, "Please remove the jury." They hurried out of the box as if they had been released for good. As soon as the door closed behind them, Dyer said, "Your Honor, I have a motion, and it should be heard in chambers." Noose glared at Jake as if he might disbar him on the spot, then grabbed his gavel and said, "Let's take a break. 15 minutes. Miss Gamble, you may go sit with your mother for a moment." The window unit in Noose's chambers was working nicely, and the office was much cooler than the courtroom. The judge flung his robe in a chair, lit his pipe, and stood behind his desk with his arms crossed. obviously upset. He glared at Jake and demanded, "Did you know she was pregnant?"
"Yes, I did. So did the district attorney."
"Lowell?"
Dyer was red-faced and furious, with sweat dripping off his chin.
"The state moves for a mistrial, Your Honor."
"On what grounds?" Jake asked coolly.
"On the grounds that we've been ambushed."
"That won't fly, Lowell," Jake said. "You saw her in court yesterday and commented to me that she was pregnant. You knew there were allegations of sexual abuse. Now there's proof." Noose asked, "Jake, did you know Kofa is the father?"
"Yes."
"And when did you know this?"
"We found out in April that she's pregnant, and she's always maintained that it was Kofa. She is prepared to testify that he repeatedly raped her."
"And you kept this quiet?"
"Who was I supposed to tell? Show me a statute or a rule or procedure that requires me to tell anyone that the sister of my client was being raped by the deceased. You can't find one. I had no duty to tell anyone."
"But you kept her in hiding," Dyer said, "away from everyone."
"You asked me twice to make her available to you, and I did so, in my office, once on April the 2nd, then on June the 8th.
Noose shot a flamethrower into the bowl of his pipe and exhaled a fog of blue smoke. No windows were cracked. The tobacco relaxed him, and he said,
"I don't like ambushes, Jake. You know that."
"Then change the rules. We have unlimited discovery in civil cases and almost none in criminal cases. Ambushes are a way of life, especially by the prosecution."
"I want a mistrial," Dyer said again.
"And why?" Jake asked. "You want to come back in 3 months and do it again?
Fine with me.
We'll bring the baby and show it to the jury. Defense exhibit number one. The blood test will be exhibit two."
Dyer's mouth dropped open, stunned again. He managed to say,
"You're pretty good at hiding witnesses, aren't you, Jake? You've already used that cheap shot. Find some new material. Gentlemen, let's talk about how to proceed. We're all in a bit of a shock, I'm afraid. First the pregnant witness, then the outburst by the family. I'm worried about our jury."
Dyer said, "Send them home, Judge. We'll try it again later."
"No mistrial, Mr. Dyer. Motion denied. Mr. Brigance, I assume that you and this witness are about to discuss the matter of sexual abuse."
"She's 14 years old, Your Honor. Far too young to consent. He was 20 years older. Sexual relations between them were illegal. Non-consensual, criminal. She is prepared to testify that he repeatedly raped her and then threatened to kill her and her brother, the defendant, if she told anyone. She was too frightened to talk."
"Can we limit some of this, Judge?" Dyer pleaded. "How graphic do you plan to get, Mr. Brigance?"
"I have no plans to discuss body parts, Your Honor. Her body speaks for itself."
The jurors are smart enough to understand what happened. Noose discharged another cloud of blue smoke and watched it swirl toward the ceiling.
"This might get ugly."
"It's already ugly, Judge. A 14-year-old girl was raped repeatedly and impregnated by a brute who took advantage of her situation. We can't change the facts. It happened. And any effort on your part to limit her testimony will give us plenty of ammo for the appeal. The law is clear, Your Honor."
"I didn't ask for a lecture, Mr. Brigance."
"Yeah, well, maybe you need one."
A moment passed as Noose chomped on the stem of his pipe while adding to the fog above the table. Finally, he said,
"I'm not sure how to gauge that outburst. Never seen anything like it, really. Wonder how it plays with the jury."
Dyer said, "I see no way it helps us."
"It doesn't help either side," Jake said.
Noose said,
I've never had one of my lawyers threatened like that, Jake. I'll deal with Mr. Kofa after the trial. Let's proceed.
No one in chambers wanted to return to the courtroom to hear Kira's testimony. Omar Nuss was determined to conduct an efficient and safe trial on his home turf, and he had harangued the sheriff into posting every possible deputy, full-time, part-time, reserve, volunteer, in and around the courthouse. After Earl's outburst and threat, even more muscle was present when the lawyers took their places and the jurors filed in. Kira returned to the stand with a tissue and braced herself. From the podium, Jake said, "Now, Kira, you said that Stuart Kofer is the father of your child, so I have to ask you a series of questions about your sexual relations with him, okay?" She bit her lip and nodded. "How many times were you raped by Stuart Kofer?" Dyer was quick to rise and object. He should have remained quiet.
"Objection, Your Honor. I object to the word rape, which implies a..."
Jake went berserk. He turned to Dyer, took a step, and yelled,
"Good God, Lowell, what do you want to call it? She's 14 years old. He was 33. "Mr. Brigance," Noose said.
Jake ignored him and took another step toward Dyer.
"You want to use something a bit lighter than rape? Say, sexual attack, molestation, sexual abuse? "Mr. Brigance, you pick the words, Lowell. The jury's not stupid. It's obvious what happened. Mr. Brigance!"
Jake took a deep breath and glared at the judge, as if he might attack him when he was finished with the district attorney.
"You're out of order, Mr. Brigance."
Jake said nothing, just kept glaring. His shirt was even wetter, the sleeves rolled up, as if he was ready to start swinging.
"Mr. Dyer."
Dyer had actually stepped back and was reeling. He cleared his throat and said,
"Your Honor, it's just that I object to the word rape."
"Objection overruled," Noose said clearly, loudly, and with no doubt that Mr. Dyer should remain in his seat whenever possible.
"Proceed."
As Jake stepped back to the podium, he glanced at Joey Kepner, number 12, and saw a contented face. "Kira, how many times were you raped by Stuart Kofer?"
"Five."
"Okay. Let's go back to the first time. Do you remember the date?" She pulled a small folded sheet of paper from a pocket and looked at it. It wasn't necessary, because she and Jake, along with Josie, Portia, and Libby, had covered the date so often that all the details were memorized.
"It was a Saturday, December the 23rd.
Jake slowly waved his hand at the jury box and said, "Please, tell the jury what happened that day."
"My mother was working, and my brother was at a friend's house. I was alone upstairs when Stuart came home. I locked my door. I had noticed him staring at my legs, and I just didn't trust him. I didn't like him, and he didn't like us. And, well, things were pretty lousy around the house. I heard him walk up the stairs, and then he knocked on the door and rattled the knob. I asked him what he wanted, and he said we needed to talk. I said I didn't want to talk, and maybe later. He rattled the doorknob again and told me to unlock the door, said it was his door, his house, and that I had to do what he said. But he was kind of nice for a change. He wasn't yelling or cussing, and said he wanted to talk about my mother, said he was worried about her. So I unlocked the door and he came in. He was already undressed and was wearing nothing but his boxer shorts."
Her voice broke and her eyes watered.
Jake waited patiently. No one was about to rush this testimony. A good cry was always helpful. Carla, Libby, and Portia were locked on to the female jurors, watching every reaction. Jake said, "I know this is difficult, but it's very important." What happened next?
He asked if I'd ever had sex, and I said no.
Dyer reluctantly got to his feet and said, "Objection, hearsay." "Overruled," Noose snapped.
"He said he wanted to have sex and wanted me to enjoy it with him. I said no. I was terrified and tried to back away from him, but he was very strong. He grabbed me, threw me onto the bed, ripped off my t-shirt and shorts, and he raped me."
She burst into tears as her entire body shook. She shoved the mic away and sobbed with both hands over her mouth. Half the jurors watched her break down. The other half looked away. Number 7, Mrs. Fife, and number 8, Mrs. Satterfield, were wiping their eyes. Oddly enough, number 3, Mr. Kingman, believed by the defense to be one of the staunchest defenders of law and order, glanced at Libby with a curious look, and she caught the unmistakable glow of moisture in his eyes. After a moment, Jake asked her, "Would you like to take a break?" The question was rehearsed, as was the answer, a quick, "No." She was a tough girl who had survived a lot and could get through this. "Now, Kira, what happened after he was finished?"
"He got up, put on his box of shorts, and told me to stop crying. He said that I'd better get used to it because we were going to do it all the time, as long as I lived in his house."
On the way up, Dyer said,
"Objection, hearsay."
"Overruled," Noose said without looking at the prosecutor. On the way down, he tossed a legal pad that fell off the table and landed on the floor. Noose ignored that too. Jake nodded at Kira, and she continued.
"He asked me if I liked it, and I said no. I was crying and shaking, and I thought, 'You stupid man, how can you think I'd like it?' As he was leaving, I was still in the bed under a sheet, and he walked over to me and slapped me in the face, but not too hard. And he said that if I told anyone, then he would kill me and Drew."
"What happened next?"
"As soon as he left, I went to the bathroom and took a bath. I felt dirty and didn't want his smell on me. I sat in a tub forever and tried to stop crying. I wanted to die, Mr. Brigance. That was the first time in my life that I thought about suicide."
"Did you tell your mother?"
"No."
"Why not?"
"I was afraid of him. We all were. And I knew he would hurt me if I told anyone. As it went on and on, I realized that I might be pregnant. I felt bad in the mornings, got sick at school, and I knew that I would have to tell Mom. I was planning on it when Stu got killed."
"Did you ever tell Drew?"
"No."
"Why not?" She shrugged and said,
"I was too afraid. And what was he supposed to do? I was scared, Mr. Brigance. And I didn't know what to do."
"And so you told no one?"
"No one."
"When was the next rape?" She looked at her sheet of paper and said,
"A week later. December the 30th. It was like the first one, at home, on Saturday, with no one else there. I tried to push him away, but he was so strong. He didn't slap me, but he threatened me again when it was over.
With a loud gasp, almost a shriek, Janet Kofer launched into another round of crying. Noose pointed to her and spoke to a bailiff. "Please remove that lady from the courtroom." Two deputies escorted her to the door. Jake watched the disturbance, and when it was finally over, he looked at his witness. "Kira, please tell the jury about the third rape." Kira was rattled by the outburst and wiped her cheeks. "Take your time," Jake had told her over and over. "There is absolutely no rush. It will be a short trial anyway, and no one is in a hurry." She leaned closer to the mic and said,
"Well, I had to change things for Saturday, so I asked Drew to stay home with me, and he did. Stuart left. A couple of weeks went by, and I managed to stay away from him. Then one afternoon, Stuart picked me up from school."
She looked at her notes.
"It was Tuesday, January 16th, and I had to stay late to work on a play, a theater project. He volunteered to get me in his patrol car, and we stopped for ice cream. It was getting late, and looking back, I think he was just killing time until it was dark. We drove home, but he took a side road not far from the church, Good Shepherd, and stopped behind an old country store, one that has been closed for a long time. It was very dark out there, not another light anywhere. He told me to get in the back seat. I had no choice. I begged him not to, and I thought about screaming, but no one would hear me. He left a rear door open, and I remember how cold it was."
"And he was in uniform?"
"Yes. He took off his gun and just pulled down his pants. I was wearing a skirt. He wrapped it around my neck. When we were driving home, I couldn't stop crying. So he took his gun and punched it into my ribs. Said to stop it. Said he would kill me if I breathed a word. Then he laughed and said he wanted me to walk into the house like nothing had ever happened. Said he wanted to see how good an actor I was. I went to my room and locked the door. Drew came to check on me."
As gripping and lurid as her testimony was, Jake knew it would be a mistake to punish the witness and the jury with the details of all five attacks. They had endured enough, and he had plenty of ammo for the rest of the trial. He stepped to the defense table to get some notes, a legal pad for a prop, and glanced at Carla on the third row. With perfect timing, she did a quick slit of the throat with an index finger. Red polish, cut, move on. He returned to the podium and continued, "Kira, on the night Stuart died, you were home with Drew and your mom, correct?"
"Yes, sir."
Dyer stood and said, "Objection, Your Honor, this is leading." With irritation, Noose said, "Sure it's leading, Mr. Dyer, but it's going into the record anyway. Overruled. Please continue, Ms. Gamble."
"Well, we were home waiting as usual. He was out late, and the situation had become much worse. Drew and I were begging Mom to leave before somebody got hurt. And I had made the decision to tell her I thought something was wrong with my body, that I might be pregnant. But I was still afraid because of him, and because there was no place for us to go. We were trapped. If she had known about the rapes and all, she would, well, I'm not sure what she would have done. But I was still afraid of him. So, anyway, long after midnight, we saw the headlights. Drew and I were huddled together on my bed with the door jammed for protection. We heard him come in. Mom was waiting in the kitchen, and they got into a fight. We heard her get slapped, and she yelled, and he cussed her, and it was just awful.
More tears, another brief delay as the witness fought to control herself. She wiped her eyes and moved closer to the mic. "Did Stuart go upstairs?" Jake asked.
"He did. Suddenly everything was quiet down there, and we heard him on the stairs, staggering, falling, obviously drunk. He was stomping up the stairs, calling my name, sort of singing it like an idiot. He rattled the doors, yelled for us to open them. We were so afraid."
Her voice cracked, and she cried some more. The terror she and Drew felt at that moment was now palpable in the courtroom. Watching that poor girl cry and wipe her face and try to be strong after all she had endured was heartbreaking. Jake asked, "Kara, would you like to take a break?" She shook her head, "No. Let's get it over with." Once Stuart backed away and went down the stairs, she and Drew knew something terrible had happened to their mother. Otherwise, she would have fought him on the stairway. They waited in the dark, curled up together, both crying, as the minutes passed. Drew went down first, then Kara, who sat on the kitchen floor with their mother and tried to revive her. Drew called 911. He was moving around the house, but Kara did not know what he was doing. Then he closed the bedroom door, and she heard the shot. When he came out, she asked him what he did, though she knew. Drew said, "I shot him." Jake listened carefully and occasionally glanced at his notes, but he managed to steal looks at the jurors. They were not watching him. Every eye was on the witness. "Now, Kara, when you came down the stairs and found your mother, were you still worried about Stuart?" She bit her lip, nodded.
"Yes, sir. We didn't know what he was doing. Once we saw Mom on the floor, we figured he'd kill us, too."
Jake took a deep breath, smiled at her, and said, "Thank you, Kara. Your Honor, the defense tenders the witness." He sat down and loosened his collar. It, along with the rest of his shirt, was soaked with sweat. Lowell Dyer approached the podium with trepidation. He couldn't attack such a vulnerable and wounded girl. She had the jury's complete sympathy, and any unkind word from the prosecutor would only play in her favor. He began a disastrous cross with, "Ms. Gamble, you keep looking at some notes you have there. May I ask about them?"
"Sure."
She pulled the folded sheet of paper from under her leg.
"Just my notes about the 5 rapes."
Jake could not suppress a grin. He had laid the trap, and Dyer was blindly walking into it.
"And when did you make these notes?"
"I've worked on them for some time. I went back through some calendars and made sure I had the dates right."
"And who asked you to do this?"
"Jake."
"Has Jake told you what to say here on the witness stand?"
She was ready.
"We've gone through my testimony, yes, sir."
"Has he coached you on how to testify?"
Jake stood and said, "Objection, Your Honor. Every good lawyer prepares his witness. What's the point, Mr. Dyer?"
"Mr. Dyer, I'm just probing, Your Honor. It's a cross-examination, and I'm allowed some latitude here.
If relevant, Your Honor, Jake said. Overruled. Continue. Dyer asked,
Could I see your notes there, Miss Gamble?
Written materials used for reference by witnesses were fair game, and the instant Dyer saw her glance at her notes, he knew he would get them. In a moment, though, he would wish he had ignored them. She held them up, as if to offer them to the prosecutor, who asked,
Your Honor, may I approach the witness?
Sure.
He took a single sheet of paper and unfolded it. Jake let the mystery of its contents hang in the air for a few seconds, then jumped to his feet.
If it pleases the court, we'll be happy to stipulate and admit Kira's notes into evidence. We even have copies here for the jurors to look at.
He waved some papers. The notes, written in her own hand and in her own words, were Libby's idea. She had seen the ruse before, in a rape case in Missouri. At the direction of the defense lawyer, the victim had prepared little reminders to help her through the ordeal of testifying. A hard-charging DA had demanded to see her notes, and it had been a fatal mistake. Kira's written accounts of the five rapes were far more graphic than her testimony. She wrote of the pain, fear, her body, his, the horror, blood, and the ever-increasing thoughts of suicide. They were numbered rapes 1 through 5. Once Dyer held the sheet of paper and glanced at its contents, he realized his blunder. He handed it back quickly and said, Thank you, Miss Gamble. Jake, still standing, said, Hang on, Judge. At this point, the jury has the right to know about the notes. The state has put them into question. Dyer said, The state has the right to be curious, Judge. This is a cross-examination. Jake said, Of course it is. Your Honor, Mr. Dyer went after the notes because he was fishing and trying to prove that this witness has been coached by me and told how to testify. He thought he had caught us when he saw the notes. Now, though, he's backing down. The notes are in play, Your Honor, and the jury has the right to see them.
I'm inclined to agree, Mr. Dyer.
You asked to see them. It doesn't seem fair to keep them away from the jury. I disagree, Your Honor, Dyer said in desperation, but could offer no reason.
Jake, still waving copies, said,
I submit the notes into evidence, Your Honor. Let's not keep this from the jury. Enough, Mr. Brigance. Just wait your turn.
After the fourth rape, Kira had written, I'm getting used to the pain. It goes away after a couple of days. But I haven't had a period in 2 months, and I'm often dizzy in the morning. If I'm pregnant, he'll kill me. And probably Mom and Drew, too. It's better if I die. I read a story about a teenager who cut her wrists with razor blades. That's what I'll do. Where to find them? Reeling, Lowell Dyer asked for a moment to confer with Musgrove. They whispered, both shaking their heads as if they had no earthly idea what to do next. Dyer had to do something, though, in order to discredit a sympathetic witness and salvage a disastrous cross, and somehow save his case. He managed to nod at Musgrove as if one of the two had hit the nail on the head. He stepped to the podium and gave her another drippy smile.
Now, Ms. Gamble, you say you were sexually assaulted by Mr. Kofer on a number of occasions.
No, sir. I said I was raped by Stuart Kofer.
She said with ice. Another response, scripted by Libby and Portia.
But you never told anyone.
No, sir. There was no one to tell.
You were enduring these terrible attacks, yet you never sought help.
From who?
What about law enforcement, the police?
Jake's heart froze at the question. He was stunned by it, but prepared, as was his witness. With perfect timing and diction, Kara looked at Dyer and said,
"Sir, I was being raped by the police."
Dyer's shoulders sagged as his mouth dropped open and he searched for a snappy retort. None arrived, nothing but warm air rushing over a parched tongue. He was suddenly mortified at the prospect of serving up another fat pitch that might land in the upper deck with the others. So he simply smiled and thanked her, as if she had really helped him, and retreated as fast as any prosecutor could possibly scurry away to the safety of his chair. Noose said,
"It's almost noon. Let's take a long lunch break and give the AC time to catch up. It's already a bit cooler in here, I think. Jurors, I ask that you all go home for lunch, and we'll reconvene at 2 sharp. The usual precautions are still in order. Do not discuss this case with anyone. We are in recess."
Chapter 47. Josie was parked behind the courthouse in a small shaded gravel lot she had found on Monday. She and Kara were almost to her car when a man with a gun approached. He was thick-chested with a short-sleeved shirt, knotted tie, cowboy boots, and a black pistol on his hip.
"Are you Josie Gamble?" he demanded.
She had seen the type many times before, and he was either a small-town detective or a private investigator.
"I am. Who are you?"
"Name's Koosman. These papers are for you."
He handed her a legal-sized envelope stuffed with folded papers.
"What is it?"
she asked, reluctantly taking the envelope.
"Bunch of lawsuits. Sorry."
He turned and walked away. Nothing but a process server. They had finally found her. The hospitals and doctors and their bill collectors and lawyers. 4 lawsuits for unpaid bills, $6,340 to the hospital in Clanton, $9,120 to the hospital in Tupelo, $1,315 to the doctors in Clanton, and $2,100 to the surgeon in Tupelo who reset her jaw. A total of $18,875, plus interest and attorney's fees of an undetermined amount. All 4 filed by the same collection lawyer in Holly Springs. The car was like a sauna, and its AC did not work. They rolled down the windows and sped away. Josie was tempted to grab the lawsuits and toss them in a ditch. She had more important things to worry about, and she couldn't remember all the times some shifty collection lawyer had tracked her down.
"How'd I do, Mom?"
Kara asked.
"You were brilliant, baby. Just brilliant."
Brilliant was indeed the verdict as the defense settled around the table in Morris Finley's rather chilly conference room. For relief, his secretary had turned the thermostat down as low as possible. They ate quickly and savored Kira's brilliance and the collapse of the prosecution. Victory was still a long shot, but she had evoked enormous sympathy from the jury. However, the problem was obvious. Kira wasn't on trial. Portia passed around a memo with the names of 11 witnesses and brief descriptions of their expected testimony. The first was Samantha Pace, ex-wife of Stuart Kofer.
She now lived in Tupelo and had grudgingly agreed to testify against her ex-husband.
"Why would you call her?"
Harry Rex asked with a mouthful of chips. "To prove he beat her," Jake said. "I'm not advocating this, Harry Rex. This is just an exercise to make sure we cover everything. This is our witness list, the same one we filed before the trial.